audio is from Anchor Church. More information is available at anchorhowell.com.
So as I mentioned earlier, I want to encourage you to open to Mark chapter 2. We're going to be in verse 18 through verse 28 this morning. And if you're a part of Anchor, you know that we've been studying the Gospel of Mark together. The Gospel of Mark was written by, believed to be written by John Mark, in around 65 AD. And the main theme of the Gospel of Mark is that God's kingdom has arrived in Jesus, the suffering king. And so that's why when you look at the picture behind me, the sermon graphic, we've got a crown in which half the crown is the crown of thorns, representing Christ's suffering, and the other half is the crown of a king, representing his authority as king. And throughout the Gospel of Mark, Mark repeatedly asks us the question, will you follow Jesus, the suffering king? Well, I want to begin our study of this passage this morning with a question. Who here likes rules? Usually, some of us, yeah, you guys are weird. Some of you like rules. I like to break rules, right? More those who like to break rules or like to make rules. I'm all about, you know, making rules, breaking rules. That's what I'm about, right? Some of you like rules. But this morning, in this passage, Jesus has two interactions with people about God's rules, God's commands. And we're going to see as we study this passage both the purpose of God's rules, his commands, as well as what empowers us to be able to follow the rules that God has given us through the scriptures. And the main idea of this passage is that Jesus frees us to joyful obedience. Jesus frees us to joyful obedience. That's what we're going to see as we look at this passage together. Well, let's look at the first of the two interactions that Jesus has found in Mark chapter 2, verse 18 through verse 22. I'm going to read these verses for us and we'll walk through them together. It says this. Now, John's disciples, this would have been John the Baptist, and the Pharisees were fasting. And to fast is to choose to, over a certain specific period of time, to stop eating food so that you can focus on God and remind yourself that your spiritual needs are greater than your physical needs. So John the Baptist's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting. And the people came, we're not told who, but people came to Jesus and they say to him, why do John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees fast, but your disciples don't fast? And Jesus replied, can the wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them? As long as they have the bridegroom with them, they cannot fast. The day will come, however, when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and they will fast in that day. No one sews a piece of unshrunken cloth in an old garment. If he does, the patch tears away from it, the new from the old, and there is a worse tear that is made. And no one puts new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the wine will burst the skins, and the wine is destroyed. And so are the skins, but new wine is for fresh wineskin. And so we find that Jesus is approached by people asking him why his disciples are not fasting in the way that John the Baptist's disciples and the Pharisees' disciples fasted. Now, according to the Jewish law, there was only one day, one time in which fasting was required to follow the law, the Mosaic law, found in Genesis through Deuteronomy. And that was on the Day of Atonement. Leviticus 16 tells us that on the Day of Atonement, that the people of Israel were to fast on that day. Apart from that, there was no place, no time that was required according to the law that one should fast. But the Pharisees, who, although they only made up about 1% of the Jewish population, they had a significant influence on the Jewish population, the Pharisees usually fasted twice a week. On Mondays and on Thursdays were their days of fasting. And they would do so as a sign of their religious commitment. And oftentimes the rabbis would talk about fasting as an affliction of the soul. And so it was a somber event, which we get, right? Because how many of us find ourselves happier when we're not eating? Right? Not eating, like, you feel happier when you don't eat? I don't know about that. I feel like when I don't eat, I get, we call it in our home, hangry. We get a little hungry and angry at the same time. But fasting was a somber event. It was an event of, you know, looking inwardly and taking a moment to experience affliction, in a sense, to remind ourselves of the need that we have for the spiritual care of God. And then Jesus responds to the question with his own question. And he says this: well, can a wedding guest, in verse 19, fast while the bridegroom is with them? How many of you have been to a wedding where you showed up at the wedding and then they're like, hey, we want to celebrate this wedding, and by the way, we're fasting. We're not eating any food at this wedding. It doesn't exist, right? Because the purpose of a wedding is to celebrate, and celebration is always connected to feasting. It's the opposite. Now, what is Jesus doing as he's communicating, as he's identifying himself as the bridegroom? There's a couple things happening here. But the first thing that Jesus is doing is that he is communicating to those who are asking the question that he is not merely a prophet, but that he is God the Son. Now, when you look at the Old Testament, and the people would have known this, the Messiah, who the people were waiting for in Israel, was never referred to as a bridegroom in the Old Testament. There was, however, one in the Old Testament who was referred to as the bridegroom, and that was God himself. We find throughout the Old Testament that God is referred to as the bridegroom. Israel is referred to as the bride. And so in Jesus saying that I am the bridegroom, what he is doing is he's communicating his equality with God the Father. He's communicating the fact that he is divine in the same way that God the Father is divine, because he is the bridegroom. But then Jesus also shares something unique in the question that he answers. He not only tells them that, hey, you know, we shouldn't be feasting at, or sorry, we shouldn't be fasting at a wedding, but instead feasting, and I'm the bridegroom, and so it's a celebration. But then he says that there's a time that comes, what, when the bridegroom will be taken away and when fasting will take place. What was Jesus speaking about there? He was speaking about the fact that as the suffering king, a time would come, right, in the future when he would be arrested, falsely tried, and hung on a cross. And so the point that Jesus is making is that with his arrival to earth, that this is a joyous, celebratory occasion. And therefore, it's not a time to fast. It's a time of celebration. It's a time of feasting. And in the same moment, he is speaking about the future in which there would be time of sadness, a time of suffering. Jesus then ends this interaction with two parables. One is he talks about a piece of clothing that has a tear in it. And, you know, we have Target and Walmart, and so we don't need to anymore. Has anybody ever, like, repaired a pair of clothing before yourself? Just, we don't need to do that, right? Doesn't exist. But in this period in time where you didn't have that many clothes, it was common where if you got a tear in your clothing, you would repair it. But Jesus makes the point that when a piece of clothing is torn, that you don't take a new piece of cloth that hasn't been shrunk yet and put it on the old piece of clothing that had already shrunk. Because if you do that, what happens? When you put that piece, that garment that has been fixed into the wash, the old garment itself doesn't shrink because it's already shrunk from being washed, but that new patch that was put on that hadn't shrunk, it shrinks. And when it shrinks, what does it do? It tears away from the garment and creates an even bigger tear, an even bigger, more damage to the piece of clothing. And then he used the example of how you wouldn't put a new wine into an old wineskin. And what he's speaking about here is that new wine would not have been completely fermented yet. And when something ferments, it expands. A wineskin that was new would have the ability to expand in a way that an old wineskin, which has already expanded, would not be able to expand anymore. And so if you took new wine that hadn't expanded completely yet, that hadn't fermented completely yet, you put it into an old wineskin that had already expanded to its limit, what happens? The wineskin breaks, and then the wineskin and the wine is lost. Now, what is Jesus communicating in these two parables? What Jesus is saying is that he came not as an addition to Judaism and its laws, but instead that he's completely new. And being completely new, he's come to make things new rather than to perpetuate the old things that existed. And in this context, he's speaking of God's commands and even the traditions of fasting and the way fasting was viewed by the religious people, religious leaders of Jesus' day. James Edwards, in his commentary on Mark, writes that if the disciples of John and the Pharisees had known or grasped the significance of who Jesus is and what he had come to do, they themselves would have been joining Jesus and feasting with him rather than fasting. Now, the good news is that Jesus came not as an addition to Judaism or its laws, but instead to make things completely new. And this is clearly demonstrated in Jesus' next interaction with the Pharisees in the following verses, beginning in verse 23 through verse 28. And I'm going to read verse 23 through verse 26 for us. It says this: one Sabbath, he, Jesus, was going through the grain fields, and they, the disciples, made their way, and his disciples began to pluck the heads of grain. And the Pharisees were saying to him, "Look, why are you doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath?" And he said to them, "Have you never read what David did, and what he was in need, and when he was in need and was hungry? He and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God in the time of Abiathar the high priest and ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful for any but the priest to eat, and also gave it to those who were with him." And so in this second interaction that Jesus has, we find that the Pharisees themselves come to Jesus, and they've got a problem with Jesus' disciples. The problem with Jesus' disciples is, in their opinion, is that the disciples are, by choosing to pluck these pieces of grain as they're walking along, because they're, you know, they need a little snack, so they're walking along the field and they were plucking pieces of grain, which was, that in itself was lawful in the Jewish law. You were allowed to do that. The problem was, according to the Pharisees, the problem for them was that it was happening on the Sabbath. Now, we, in the Western context, don't understand the weight of the Sabbath in the ways that the Jewish people viewed it. For a Jewish person, the laws and the command of the Sabbath was something that was very unique to them. That and circumcision were the two ordinances, isn't the right word, observances of Judaism that separated them from the rest of the world. And so the laws of the Sabbath weren't merely just one other commandment in the Ten Commandments that we need to follow. For the Jewish people, the Sabbath was, the law of the Sabbath was a point of pride in saying, look at how much better we are, how we are distinct from everybody around us. And so this is why you see multiple times throughout the Gospels where the religious leaders come at Jesus specifically in regards to the Sabbath and the way that Jesus acts during the Sabbath versus the way that they believe he should act during the Sabbath. The Sabbath was so important to the Jewish people and specifically to the religious leaders that they had what was called the Mishnah, which was a oral interpretation of the law, of the Torah, of the first five books of the Bible that we have. And this oral interpretation, this Mishnah, was a full set of rules that were put in place to help you follow the rules found in the first five books of the Bible. And so while Exodus chapter 20, chapter 35, Leviticus chapter 23, and a couple other places in the Torah in the first five books of the Bible give us instructions, or give the people of Israel specifically instructions on how they were to follow the law of the Sabbath, the command of the Sabbath, there wasn't a ton of detail that was given apart from it was to be a day of complete rest and no work. But what the Pharisees did is they then took and created the Mishnah, so that they then created 39 different categories that would define what work was, so that they could make sure that nobody broke the original commands in Exodus chapter 20, chapter 35, Leviticus chapter 23 on the Sabbath. And some of their commands were, you know, made sense. Like you weren't allowed to work in your field, things like that. But then there were other classifications of work that were just kind of random and out there. So they had one where it was like you couldn't write more than one letter. And this isn't in terms of like writing a letter to a friend. It's like writing an actual letter of the alphabet. I don't know what you're doing with one letter of the alphabet, that somehow that makes sense and you can do that. But, you know, you go two letters, like I understand that. But that was one of the rules they had. Another rule that they had was that you couldn't walk more than 1,999 steps. And so on the Sabbath, you know, people probably, like, instead of shuffling, they probably like took really big steps, make sure they could stay within the realm. But you could maximize, you know, what you were allowed to do. It's kind of a joke. Didn't land. That's okay. But the point is that all they created all these extra laws to follow the Sabbath, because the Jewish people really viewed the law of the Sabbath to be like this. It was viewed more significantly than pretty much any other command for them in the Torah, in the first five books of the Bible. And so therefore, their classification of what the disciples were doing as being unlawful wasn't unlawful according to the scriptures, but it was possibly unlawful according to their interpretation of the scriptures and the commands found in the Mishnah, which they had created. And the Pharisees themselves hadn't created. The Mishnah had been created through oral. It had been passed down probably 200 years earlier, but the Mishnah, which they held to, is kind of having the same authority as the Torah itself, as the first five books of the Bible. Now, how did Jesus respond to the religious leaders? It's interesting here, because in other parts of the Gospels where Jesus has interactions with the religious leaders, his response is actually to come back to his authority. So if you remember a few weeks ago, when he told the man who was dropped down from the ceiling, who was lame, he told that man that your sins are forgiven, and the religious leaders had a problem with that. He responded to them by coming back to his authority, pointing to his authority as healer, saying, hey, if I can physically heal this man, which he does, then I have the authority as well to forgive sins. But this is one moment where Jesus' interactions, he doesn't respond to the issue that the Pharisees bring up with reminding them of his or pointing to his authority, but instead he reminds them of a story that they were all very well aware of. He reminds them of the time that David, who before he was king, at that time the king would have been Saul. There's this time in history where David, before he was king, he had fallen out of favor with Saul, because Saul knew that David was going to be the next king. And so Saul was chasing and trying to kill David. And David had a number of men with him who were part of his party, and they were fleeing from Saul. And as they're fleeing from Saul, they're hungry, they're famished, they're tired, and they were told that they come to the city of Nob, and at the city of Nob, they meet a priest, and they ask this priest, do you have any bread for us? And the priest's response, and it's found in 1 Samuel 21, the priest's response is that, you know, I don't have any common bread for you. In other words, bread that anybody could eat. But he says, but I have the bread of the presence. And the bread of the presence was bread that had been consecrated to God in the temple. And the Torah, the Jewish Mosaic law found in Genesis through Deuteronomy, explicitly stated that only priests were allowed to eat this bread. David, however, asks for this bread. The priest chooses to give him the bread. Him and his men who are with him eat the bread. They are nourished, and then they continue their journey away from being captured by Saul. Now, what's interesting is that there's nowhere in scriptures that condemns what David did there when he actually broke God's law by eating the bread of the presence. And the reason for that was because God's primary concern in that moment was caring for his servant David, the anointed king of Israel. Now Jesus, in citing David's violation of the Mosaic law, was not doing so to excuse the actions of his disciples, but what he's doing is he is showing that there's a precedent that has been set. Jesus is inviting the comparison between himself and David. And he's doing this in the same way that he is comparing himself or saying that he is the bridegroom, with the purpose of pointing to his divinity. Because what Jesus is doing is he's saying that, look, I, just like David, who ate the bread of presence, and it was not condemned, even though he broke the law, he's making this comparison between David and himself, showing to the Pharisees that God, who had promised that upon David's throne would reign one who would reign eternally, that he, Jesus, is the Son of Man, the Son of David, who would reign on David's throne for all of eternity. Now, Jesus' kingship and his authority is further demonstrated in verse 27 and 28, where Jesus clearly spells out the purpose of God's commands. Look at verse 27. It says this, "And he said to them," Jesus said to them, "the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath." Now this verse clearly communicates to us the purpose of God's commands. What Jesus is saying is that God's laws and the commands, such as the Sabbath, was made for the flourishing, for the good of man, versus man being created so that they could follow God's commands. Jesus is showing us that God's commands were put in place for our flourishing. In other words, God did not create his commands so that he could stifle our lives or be a killjoy, or even more so that he could kind of feel powerful as he forces us to follow his commands. But instead, he created every command that he has created as a means of not only for us to be able to glorify and honor him, which is the ultimate purpose of humanity, but secondarily for the benefit of our life, for our flourishing. Now, what did the religious leaders view to be the purpose of God's commands? Based on Matthew chapter 11, verse 28, we know that the religious leaders viewed the purpose of God's commands to be something that they had so that they might attain the means of approaching God on their own efforts. So they viewed God's commands as something that existed that could prove their worthiness of being able to approach God. And then they taught God's commands in that way. And this is why Jesus, in Matthew chapter 11, verse 28, speaks about how the religious leaders' teaching of the law worked as a great burden upon the backs of the people. Because the law was viewed as something that you needed to exert effort and energy towards, and if you maybe worked hard enough, you would then be possibly worthy enough to approach God based on your merit of following these commands and these laws. And so they didn't view God's commands as a means of flourishing. apart from defining flourishing as feeling better about themselves than others. And in that sense, the religious leaders kind of viewed it that way because they also used the law to kind of allow themselves to feel better about themselves than others. There's a tradition of a Jewish prayer that Jewish men would pray in which they would, you know, thank God that they weren't like the heathens, you know, who were not deserving of God's love in the way that they were deserving of God's love. But generally speaking, they didn't view the purpose of God's commands as a means by which we might flourish, but instead they viewed it as this weight, this burden that must be carried that would then allow us to possibly be worthy enough to stand before God. Now, we, on the other hand, how do we tend to view God's commands? We are in a Western culture, we're individualistic. So a number of you raised your hand, said that you like rules. And I understand that because rules can bring security, right? But generally speaking, being from the West, valuing individualism, we tend to respond to God's commands or view the purpose of God's commands in an opposite way to the way that the religious leaders did. While the religious leaders viewed God's commands as being a means to, you know, become worthy to approach God, and that's why they would create more commands to be able to follow the original commands. We tend to view the purpose of God's commands or view God's commands as in many ways as being kind of a limiter to our joy. So that when our desires come into conflict with God's commands, our natural response tends to be to, in that moment, push back against God's commands, to give ourselves a special dispensation, saying that, like, my situation is kind of unique, therefore these commands don't apply to me. And in the end, we actually have a similar root belief about God as the religious leaders do in that moment. And that similar belief is the belief that we are better at making our lives flourish than God is. And so we go, I'm better at making my life flourish than God is. Therefore, when God's commands come into conflict with my desires, I am going to remain in charge of my life so that I can make sure that I flourish. The religious leaders, right? Go, I am better at making my life flourish than God can. Therefore, I am going to follow God's commands by my effort as the hero of the narrative so that I can flourish through my pursuit of following God's commands. Now, notice Jesus doesn't end his interaction at verse 27. He actually ends it at verse 28, which is like, there's this really good turn that takes place here. It says this. He says, so the Son of Man, and that phrase Son of Man, Mark uses, points to Christ's divinity. He says, so the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. Now there's a couple things happening here. Kids, any of you guys remember who instituted, who put the rule of the Sabbath in place? Any of you guys know? God did. Does anybody remember when did the first Sabbath take place? I can open this up to everybody. It's a little bit of a trick question. When does the first Sabbath take place? It's in Genesis chapter 2, I think. On the seventh day of creation, right? What does God do? Yes. God rested. He rested. That was the first Sabbath. On the seventh day, after 6 days of creation, God then looks at everything, says it is not only good, but it is very good, and then he rests. He takes a Sabbath. He institutes the Sabbath. Now, Jesus, in making this statement, I am the Lord of the Sabbath, what is Jesus doing? Jesus is bringing himself to be equal, once again, in the way that he did with the bridegroom, in the way that he does with comparing himself to David, he brings himself to be equal with God who instituted the Sabbath by saying, God who instituted the Sabbath, I actually have the authority. I am Lord over the Sabbath that God the Father instituted, and therefore I myself am divine. But that's not all that's happening here. Let me come back for just, going to step back for just a moment, a few verses back. Who or what were the Pharisees looking to for their hope? They were looking to the law. And in this context specifically, they were looking to the law of the Sabbath. That was where their hope was. That's why they were so cranked up about what they perceived to be the breaking of the Sabbath. Because the law of the Sabbath was where their hope rested. Where does our hope rest? Well, true hope is found not in the law of the Sabbath, but what? In Jesus Christ, the Lord of the Sabbath. And when we think about Jesus as the Lord of the Sabbath, we're reminded of Hebrews chapter 4, verse 8 through 9. I'm just going to read these verses for a moment. It says this, or verse 9. So then there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God, for whoever has entered God's rest has also rested from his work as God did from his. So Hebrews chapter 4, verse 9 reminds us that Jesus, the Lord of the Sabbath, was not simply the Lord of the Sabbath in the sense that he was equal with the Father who instituted the Sabbath, but also it was that he was the Lord of the Sabbath and that he stepped down to earth to secure the eternal Sabbath rest for us. And so Jesus, as the Lord of the Sabbath 2,000 years ago, what does he do? He steps down to earth. He becomes fully human while remaining fully God. He then lives a life we cannot live, a life of perfection, following every command found in the Torah, in the Mosaic law, in the scriptures as a whole. He follows every law, perfectly obedient. And then what does he do? He then chooses the path of suffering. While remaining king, he chooses the path of suffering, becoming a ransom for many through the giving of his life as a substitute to atone for our sins. And what are the last words that Jesus says on the cross? We all know this. It is finished. What was finished? The work that he had set out to do was finished. What does Hebrews 4 tell us? Hebrews 4 tells us that we are able to enter into the eternal rest because the work has been completed on our behalf. Pointing to the fact that we are able to enter into the eternal Sabbath, enter into not only the salvation that we receive at the moment of our faith in Jesus' finished work on the cross, but the eternal Sabbath that takes place as we enjoy Jesus, our big brother, high priest, and king for all of eternity in heaven. Jesus, in saying it is finished, he's speaking about the work that he had come to earth to do as the Lord of the Sabbath, bringing Sabbath rest to us. And then after being buried, 3 days later, he resurrects from the dead, conquering sin, Satan, and death. So that, right, we can be adopted into the family of God, become part of the church, the bride of Christ, of whom Jesus is our bridegroom. Now, how does this all connect to where the source of obeying God's commands comes from? Well, it connects in a couple of ways. The first way it connects is this, is that at the moment in which we are rescued from our sin through faith in Jesus' finished work on the cross, we are given a new life, a new life in which the Holy Spirit empowers us not only to believe that God's commands are for our flourishing, but also empowers us to joyfully seek to obey God's commands. But not only that, the gospel also empowers us to obey God's commands, not only by transforming us, as Romans 6 says, giving us a new life, but also as reminding us that our obedience is not a means of achievement, but instead our obedience to God's commands is in response to what we have already received in and through Christ. And this is how Jesus frees us to joyful obedience. And so my encouragement for you this week is that in the moments, and we all experience this throughout the week, in the moments that your desires come into conflict with God's commands, this could be everything from the way that you're interacting with money, the way that you're interacting with people, the way that you are at work or at school, the way that you're engaging with the local church, and all these different places. That in that moment, when your desire comes into conflict with God's commands, my encouragement to you is number one, is to remember that God's commands are for our flourishing. Every one of God's commands in the scriptures are for our flourishing. And then two, that you would remember that because of what Christ has done as the Lord of the Sabbath, the work that he has accomplished that has been finished on the cross, you have been ushered into, as Hebrews 4 verse 9 says, a Sabbath rest. So that your obedience is not a means of achievement, because there's nothing you can do to achieve what you have. That has been perfectly completed in Christ. And just FYI, even on your best day, you're not going to be able to obey God in the way that Jesus obeyed God. And that's actually good news. But that your obedience is not as a means of achieving God's love or worthiness to approach him, but instead it is in response to what you have received in Christ, the Lord of the Sabbath, who was perfectly obedient on your behalf in the midst of your disobedience and died in your place so that you might be rescued and redeemed. So my encouragement is for you to reflect on those two things. And as those two realities drop from your head to your heart, you will be freed to not just obedience, but I specifically put in there joyful obedience, because it's a response to joyful good news of the gospel.